You're listening to the MLB Pipeline Podcast with your host, Ed Randall.
Hi, everybody. I'm Ed Randall, and welcome to the MLB.com Pipeline Podcast. I'm joined by our draft and minor league experts, Jonathan Mayo and Jim Callis. Guys, great to have you, of course. We're first going to talk about the ongoing College World Series. Last year, Vanderbilt and Virginia met in the finals. Jim, you think it could happen again?
Yeah, I do. I mean, they're both in the driver's seat right now. The way they have a double bracket system that's double elimination. Both those teams won their first two games, have won the winner's bracket game on their half of the overall bracket, and now they only have to win one more game to get to the best of three finals. They both have moved through to Friday, and on one half you have Florida and Miami playing for the right to face Virginia, and they would have to beat them twice, and then TCU and LSU playing for the right to face Vanderbilt again, and they would have to beat Vanderbilt twice.
And Vanderbilt and Virginia are both, as Jim said, are both 2-0. So, Jim, here's my trivia question for you, since you are the College World Series guru, although who knows when you're actually going to get there. When was the last time a team won the College World Series without starting 2-0?
Without starting 2-0.
Correct.
Don't know off the top of my head. I was just trying to go back through the recent winners, and I want to say South Carolina, but one of the South Carolina teams is my best guess.
I thought I had finally stumped Jim Callis, but you're correct. 2010 South Carolina Gamecocks won the College World Series after going 1-1 in their first two games.
Yeah, and that was the emergence of Michael Roth as one of the best, I think, postseason pitchers in NCAA history. He was, I think, a sophomore then. And I don't think he had started much for South Carolina. And they had to come through the loser's bracket against, I want to say it was their bitter arch rival, Clemson. Very bitter loss for Clemson. And Michael Roth had to start the Friday night game. And I think he took a shutout into the ninth inning. And after that, it was a long time before he gave up another earned run in the NCAA postseason. And they won two national titles and finished second in 2012 to Arizona.
So maybe this year's Michael Roth will be Brandon Waddell from Virginia. I mean, they've got to be the surprise, right? And this is a team that barely made postseason play, and here they are back where they were a year ago without their ace, Nathan Kirby, pitching at all, and they're right back where they were a year ago. I don't think anyone could have predicted that.
No, I mean, the way the season was ending, they were dicey, I think, for getting into even the ACC tournament, without which it would have been very dicey to get into the NCAA tournament. And they've just been on a roll ever since. They've stunned Maryland with a couple of late comebacks in the Super Regionals. They've been, very good, 5-3-1-0. I think Waddell pitched a shutout or pitched very well in last year's College World Series, too. And, the curious thing would be, maybe Nathan Kirby, I don't know his availability. There's talk that maybe he pitches, although there's been that talk, I think, in both the regionals and super regionals, at least a little possibility. So, Virginia is in the driver's seat. I mean, I would think on that half of the bracket, Florida has used their two guys who could be first-round picks next year, and A.J. Puck and Logan Shore. I would guess you could probably bring Logan Shore back on Saturday if they get there. They would have to beat Miami tonight and then Virginia in a game on Friday. I think the thing that helps the Gators in that regard is they do have a very deep bullpen. So, I think TCU probably has a little bit better chance on the other side because they still have two pretty good starters, and Tyler Alexander and Mitchell Traver, who haven't pitched, and then they could bring Preston Morrison back if they forced a Saturday game. But, it's tough to come out of the loser's bracket, but it's not impossible, and I like Florida's bullpen depth, and I like TCU's rotation depth to at least give them a fighting chance to do that. And having said that, watch Miami and LSU win, and then who knows?
No, that won't
cover all your bases.
That won't happen, Jim, because it's gonna play out exactly the way you said just now when you answered that question about South Carolina. You guys did terrific work on the draft. Congratulations to both of you. And before we go back and look at your impressions of it, let me ask you this. Jonathan, is it time to trade draft picks? Of course, it can't happen before 2017 when the new labor deal would be in effect. But having been through another draft, do you believe that it's time to trade draft picks?
I've always been in favor of that, at least in some limited sense. They want to, whatever they do, they want to make sure that there isn't a system set up where teams can just punt and, not spend money on the draft. I think that's what they would like to avoid. They kind of dip their toes in the waters by having those competitive balance round picks being tradable, and a lot of them have been traded, and there's been value in them, clearly, as teams have looked to add picks. So I think it would add some interest and some excitement. I think that whatever they might do, it probably has to be limited in some way. It's not going to just be free market insanity. But I think I'd like to see it. I wouldn't mind, a situation where Commissioner Manfred comes up and announces a trade. But I don't know if that's ever going to happen. They may cut it off the day before, but I think it would add some intrigue as teams try to move up and down. This year would have been a really good year to trade down for extra picks, I think, with the lack of separation at the top and some decent depth as you went on a little more. If the Minnesota Twins wanted to trade, they were happy to get Tyler J, don't get me wrong, but they could have traded that pick for, two later picks. Maybe they would have been interested in doing that.
Jim, it seems inside the halls of the front offices that there is, informally, a lot of people in favor of trading draft picks. What do you think?
Well, I think that might be true, but I've also heard, this has been bandied about for years. There's a lot of people who are against it, too, and I don't think the issue is going to be getting the union to sign off on this like they do with all draft things because it's related to free agent compensation. I don't think the union's really going to care that much if the teams trade draft picks. I think it's more the teams, and really it's the owners having a united front on what they want to do. I mean, it would definitely create more interest. It would give you more flexibility. If I'm a contender, maybe you look at the Astros this year where they had the second and fifth overall pick. The Astros are winning at the major league level. Maybe they could add a really nice, piece to the major league club, maybe a starting pitcher, if they could have traded the number five pick in a package. So it would give teams more flexibility. But at the same time, I've also talked to a number of executives over the years who think it would allow the players to have too much control over their destination. I mean, we just had the player to be named later rule, or not, adjusted, or when you can trade draft pick rule adjusted after Trey Turner was a player to be named later. And the reason that rule was put in, where you couldn't trade a player until a year after he signed, was back in 1985. Pete and Caviglia did not want to play with the Montreal Expos, and he was a first round pick, and he basically told him, you don't sign me, then, if you don't trade me, I'm not going to sign. And so they wound up, he was the eighth overall pick. They wound up trading him to the Rangers in a trade that wound up doing nothing for the Expos, and that's why that rule is in place. And what if you had a situation, Bryce Harper in the Sports Illustrated article when he was 16 years old talked about how much he loved the Yankees. What if Bryce Harper told the Washington Nationals, I'm not going to sign with you? He was only 17 at that point, so it's not like he was wasting, would have been, putting his career on hold for 3 years or anything like that by going to a four-year college. What if he said, I won't play unless you trade me to the Yankees? So I won't claim I've taken a temperature of all 30 teams on that, but I do know there are club officials who worry about giving the players extra leverage to basically force trades to teams that are willing to pay them the most.
Guys, let's take a look back at the draft by categories. Let's start, Jonathan, with you. Winners, franchises that were winners, which ones?
Well, I think the first team that jumped to mind is almost immediately, and it's how they did it at the very top of the draft. And obviously, you don't know for a number of years, especially when you look over the span of the top 10 rounds and beyond that. But I'll continue to give the Colorado Rockies some love, starting with that first pick at number three, which you would think, it's hard to mess that up. And I'm not saying that they would have messed it up if they had taken Tyler J. But Brendan Rodgers was the best player on the board. And they went with the best player on the board instead of going we need pitching, so let's take the pitcher route. Tyler J may be the fastest guy to the big leagues, and, he may get to pretty soon, but he also may be a relief pitcher. And this is an organization that still looks back on not taking Evan Longoria not too fondly. So they didn't want to make that mistake again twice. So I like that they did that. And then they got Mike Nikorak at 27. They continued to go for some upside guys later on in the draft. So I like that they went after some high-ceiling guys and didn't worry about organizational need as much as anything else. So they were the team that jumped to mind right away, and they still sort of stand out as a team that I think did quite well on draft day.
Jim, biggest winner?
Yeah, well, I'll second what Jonathan said. I think the teams that usually look the best this soon, and we have to wait and see who signs, are the teams with the extra picks. And, you know, I think the obvious team for me was the Astros. You know, they're the first team ever to have two top five overall picks in the same draft. And they got Alex Bregman from LSU, the shortstop, and Kyle Tucker from Plant High, an outfielder, two of the better hitters in this draft. And then they kind of finessed Daz Cameron down to pick 37. Mike Cameron's son, good solid all-around center fielder. So that gave him three of our seven best prospects overall. You know, that'll be the bulk of their draft. They also got Thomas Eshelman from Cal State Fullerton, who's an extreme strike thrower, and closer Riley Farrell from TCU. Both of those guys have seen action in the College World Series, as has Bregman. So I like that. And then I think if you're going to go with a team that didn't have any extra picks, because, again, it's easy to like the teams that pick a bunch at the top, I liked what the Rays did. I thought getting Garrett Whitley at 13 could wind up being a steal. He might have as high a ceiling as anybody in this draft. They got the best offensive catcher in the draft in round two in Chris Betts, and then they kept going. They got a couple good college hitters in Maryland second baseman Brandon Lau and Virginia outfielder Joe McCarthy in rounds three and five. And then they got a potential late-inning guy in Brandon Koch in the fourth round, a right-hander from Dallas Baptist, and had some later picks that were effective too. So if you're going with just overall, I think the Astros jump out with all their extra picks, and if you're going for no extra help, I would go with the Rays.
All right. Those are the biggest winners. Now the biggest losers, Jonathan.
Well, I've lost about 5 pounds just from the stress of the draft. Does that count? No, that's not what you mean. You know, I don't want to make it sound like I'm straddling the fence. It's just I find it very hard. There were some drafts that I wasn't particularly fond of. You know, the Angels taking Taylor Ward at 26, I think, was a bit of a surprise. We had him at the very end of the top 100 of our top 200. Decent college catcher, but nothing too exciting. When I thought if they were looking for college position players, there were other choices. There weren't other catchers really necessarily to choose from. Austin Rye might have been a better choice, but that didn't thrill me, and the rest of their draft was just okay. You know, it's interesting because initially I didn't like the Pirates taking Kevin Newman at 19. I would have preferred for them to go more upside. Mike Nikorak was a guy that was high on their board. Here in Pittsburgh, I heard him, Newman interviewed, and it, you know, the Pirates were always on his radar, so it wasn't that big of a surprise. So I wasn't thrilled with how they started, but then they got Cabrian Hayes a little bit later, and then Jim and I have been doing these sort of draft recaps for each division, and I just wrote the NL Central, and I was actually a little pleasantly surprised with who they got later on. They got like seven top 200 guys, as the draft went on. So they did better as the draft went on, even if I wasn't thrilled with Kevin Newman up top.
Jim?
Yeah, I guess the team that and I'd hesitate to use the word losers because, again, you don't know who's going to sign, but I guess a team that had extra picks that did not blow me away was probably the Orioles. You know, they got DJ Stewart at 25, Florida State outfielder. I like DJ. Wonder about the power a little bit because he's got an extreme crouch at the plate, and he's an all-bat guy. But their next two picks kind of confused me a little bit. They took Ryan Mountcastle, a Florida high school infielder. And, you know, and Mountcastle, I think most teams had him as more of a third-round pick, not a first-rounder. And then in round two, they took a Georgia high school right-hander named Jonathan Hughes. And I thought most teams viewed him as more of a fourth to sixth-rounder. I mean, you usually get picked by the team that likes you the most, so that happens. But I thought they could have maybe done more damage with those three picks. And then, you know, the flip side teams I think the teams that always look the worst on draft day are the teams that lost the most picks. And the White Sox lost a second and third-rounder. So that they only had one pick in the first three rounds. They did get Carson Fulmer. They did want one of the better college pitchers, and they got him. But a lot of the success of their draft is going to hinge on Carson Fulmer just because he was the only guy they had out of the first 111 picks.
Jonathan, surprise picks.
Well, and I'll go back to the Angels. Taylor Ward at 26 was certainly a surprise. I mean, I caught wind of it a little bit ahead of time, but wasn't quite sure whether to believe it, because he was not one of those college bats whose name you were starting here at the back end of the first round at all. So that's probably the biggest surprise. Obviously, Daz Cameron, you know, we started hearing it, and you know, Jim was smart enough in his mock draft. Congratulations, by the way, Jim. He beat me 9-8 this year.
Close one.
Largely because of that. He didn't put him in the first round, and I guess I was too weak to pull the trigger on that. So those were probably the biggest, you know, surprises. I guess Ward was more surprising than Cameron, just because we knew the Cameron thing might be happening.
Jim?
Yeah, it's I was going to say the two first rounders, I think, were the biggest surprises we've touched on. It was Ward and it was Mountcastle. You know, Josh Naylor, the Canadian slugger, who might have as much power as just about anybody in the draft, went 12th overall to the Marlins. But that rumor was picking up a lot of steam. He performed great on a Baseball Canada swing through the Dominican Republic against professional pitchers. So even though that was a surprise, you kind of heard that one coming. The other guy if you extend it through the supplemental first round, who I think was taken higher than most people thought he might have been, was Austin Riley, Mississippi High School third baseman, right-hander by the Braves. Actually came into the year as more of a pitcher. His stuff was not as sharp. He fits the third base profile with power and arm strength, but you know, I kind of thought he was more of a third round pick than a supplemental first rounder.
I'll throw one other sort of semi surprise out, just because college pitching that performs well tends to do pretty well, and the fact that Kyle Funkhauser and especially Walker Buehler dropped down into the 20s, that was a little bit of a surprise. And I know the Dodgers were thrilled to have those guys fall in their lap. Funkhauser didn't pitch well for a stretch, but then kind of righted the ship. I don't know if signability ended up coming into play there or not, but probably the Walker Buehler one, most of us had him going somewhere in the 11 to 16 range, and the fact that he dropped all the way down into the 20s was a little bit of a surprise.
And on that same vein, if we're looking at guys who were surprises for dropping, you know, caught throw the college pitchers in there, and they did seem to go, that second tier did all seem to go lower than expected. John Harris in Missouri State wound up going 29 to the Blue Jays, and that's another team I think was thrilled to see that name on the board when they got to pick.
Jonathan, give us an update on how the signings are going.
Fast and furious, which isn't surprising. Ever since the new system, when people, you know, teams tend to come into the draft knowing who they're going to take, you know, as they go, they obviously have to adjust. But there are a lot of phone calls, say, after day one where they have to determine, hey, will you sign for X amount? So they've got a lot of things lined up, and then it's just a question of physicals and you know, dotting the I's and crossing the T's on contracts and things like that. But, you know, they're happening pretty quickly. So far, I guess the highest guys that have signed officially are Dylan Tate and Kyle Tucker. They're number 4 and 5. Brendan Rodgers, number 3 pick, is today is Wednesday. He's signing late Wednesday afternoon in Colorado. So that will be a done deal in the not-too-distant future. Obviously, the college guys who are still playing can't sign, but no real surprises as of yet. I think there are a couple guys who got drafted later who are tough signs. It'll be interesting to see whether they get signed, but those will be more along the lines of when teams figure out how much pool money they have left, whether or not they can make a run at them. But I think, Jim, I'm going to guess you'll agree that it's been a steady clip and kind of how it's been the last couple of years.
Yeah, with the new system, I mean, you know, the old system where MLB had an informal slotting system and MLB solely established the recommended values for each pick, which frankly were ridiculously low. They were about 50% below market value. And the slots in the last year, the informal system, were 10% lower in 2011 than they were in 2007. So basically, you know, I think you had players look at those slot numbers as not being realistic, and basically that's the number you can get if you want to sign and play right away. Otherwise, you can get a lot more of it the longer you wait. With the new system, with the bonus pools and the slots determined by MLB and the union and raising each year with, being in parallel with the increase in revenues in baseball, They're much more fair. MLB isn't taking a hands-on process to try to get teams to save money. The bonus pools do that. If you spend too much, more than 5% over your pool, you lose first-round picks. So they are happening quicker. I think a lot of the prices are determined, at least informally agreed to before the draft. And I want to say, as of right now, Wednesday morning, I think 20 of the 36 first-rounders are signed. Six of those guys are playing, or five of them are still in the College World Series, and Andrew Benintendi's team has been eliminated. So those guys couldn't really get done anyway. And that leaves, of the other 10, I bet at least half of them are probably signed by the end of the week.
All right, guys, let's turn to the major leagues. And boy, what a rookie class is developing in front of our eyes as teams continue to call up their top prospects. It started with the Chris Bryant controversy late in spring training, but my goodness, he's sure lived up to all the hype. Jonathan, all these guys come into the major leagues, and it is just wonderful to see this flow of talent.
It's kind of crazy. I mean, I don't remember seeing anything like this before in terms of so many guys who were in our top 15, coming into the season, who are now in the big leagues, especially with Carlos Correa and then Francisco Lindor and Byron Buxton all coming up. I want to thank Major League organizations for calling those guys up right after the draft, as Jim and I were still in a post-draft coma. So that was fun. But it's really, I think, unprecedented in a lot of ways, and a lot of fun. I think it's creating a lot of good energy. People want to know who's next. I think over the years, more and more people are paying attention to the prospects anyway, and everyone has got their own little countdown clock as to when guys might get called up. We get questions all the time from Cleveland fans: when is Lindor coming up? When is Lindor coming up? So. The excitement around a player, it's really something to behold within the market and even around baseball. And it's all these young stars coming up, I think, is just going to add more interest and intrigue to the league.
Jim?
Yeah, no, it's been exciting. I think it's going to take its toll on the futures game, unfortunately, because a lot of these guys would have been obvious picks for the futures game. But, I think we talked about this on an earlier podcast. Kind of a strange year coming in that I believe the top 12 prospects on the MLB pipeline, top 200, all began the year in the minors, which is highly unusual. But we've seen so many of these guys come up from Bryant and Addison Russell on the Cubs, to Joey Gallo and Noah Syndergaard and Carlos Rodon, and those guys are all playing pretty well. And then just to see Carlos Correa and Byron Buxton and Francisco Lindor and now Kyle Schwarber come up in the last 7 to 10 days, I don't remember. It's funny. I was gonna say I don't remember the last time we had three guys the likes of Buxton, Correa, and Lindor come in within a week of each other. But then we kind of saw that back in April when Bryant, Russell, and Rodon came up all to Chicago within days of each other. But, it's made for some fun prospect coverage this year.
All with incredibly high upsides, Jonathan. And really, to both of your points, this is almost unprecedented to see this flow of talent, especially since, as you guys said, they all started the minor leagues.
Well, you look at Gallo and Buxton, they were both in Double-A when they got called up. And Buxton hasn't played a whole lot of baseball. He missed most of last year, all but I think 40 games because of injuries, and was really heating up and sort of performing like the number one prospect is expected to, as the year started wearing on this year. So it's not a huge surprise, maybe a little tiny bit just because of the lack of playing time he had. Gallo was another one, was because of injury. He's getting a chance to show what he can do, even if it's for a limited amount of time, just to get his feet wet. So, not huge shocks. It's not like when the Mets called up, this is not a top 100 guy, but they called up Akil Maris from the Florida State League to pitch out of their bullpen, which no one saw coming. But, guys do make the jump from Double-A from time to time. I think it surprised some that Buxton and Gallo came up when they did. Gallo also missed a few weeks at the beginning of the season with a minor injury. So that added to the excitement of it because it was, Lindor, pretty much from the time he got sent down from big league camp, where he was ridiculously good in spring training, people were wondering when it was going to happen. And then they sent Jose Ramirez down, and I think the buzz really started generating. So that one didn't surprise anybody. I don't think the Correa call-up really surprised anybody. But when looking at in total, we're looking at all these guys have, perennial all-star potential, and that's what makes it all the more exciting.
You mentioned those guys, and then, of course, there's Jock Peterson, who's doing so well in center field for the Dodgers, and Eduardo Rodriguez at Boston, who came in the Andrew Miller trade, and Lance McCullers and Yasmani Tomas at Arizona, and Carlos Rodon at the White Sox, and Devin Travis at Toronto. My goodness, Jim, it could be a year for the ages if it plays out for these guys like so many people expect.
It could, we could still see guys like Corey Seager could get called up by the Dodgers. If the Twins continue to win, maybe they'll look to put Miguel Sano's power bat in the lineup. He had more Double-A experience than Byron Buxton did coming into the year, also coming back from injuries. So there's more guys, waiting in the wings. We could, maybe the Yankees, if the Yankees continue to contend and challenge, Luis Severino could be in the big leagues. So. You can look and see a bunch more guys who could be up too. I mean, this could keep getting better.
Can't wait for it to happen. Guys, great being with you. Great work. On behalf of Jonathan Mayo and Jim Callis, I'm Ed Randall. Thanks so much for listening to the Pipeline Podcast.